today, finishing up the history section of our lesson, Rethinking Race, How Shall We Be Christian? Next week, we'll start the What Shall We Do? On the basis of the first two parts. We'll start part three next week. We're too far into the lesson to give a proper recap. In a moment, I'll give you an improper recap. But if you've missed any of the lessons online, I would encourage you to listen online because they do kind of build one on the other. So here's a not quite proper recap. First, we saw that one of the central teachings of Jesus has been skewed in our current understanding because we live in such an individualized society. Jesus lived rooted in, immersed in, a much more collective worldview than we do. Consequently, when we come to that centerpiece of Jesus' teaching, we use the Greek word metanoia, the idea that when we find ourselves walking a path of harm, it is to us to stop, to back up, and to go a different way. When we come to that central teaching of Jesus, metanoia, especially around something as significant as our nation's original sin, racial inequity, we tend to think as individuals as opposed to collectively as a whole. So then we feel that we must, if we're going to walk a different path, we must stop having personal bigotry, or we must turn from personal meanness toward people of other races. But we saw that's not a big enough construct to capture what Jesus was talking about. For him, an us framework calls us to a much bigger reality. Followers of Jesus did not just sign up for advancing in personal virtue. We did that to be sure, but we signed up to be repairers of the broken systems in our world that are breaking people. We signed up to stop, turn around, walk another way for our whole society, for the world that we inhabit. Repairers of the earth. That's how our Jewish heritage speaks of it. So when it comes to the sin of racial inequity, personal bigotry is only a small part of what is at stake. So yes, let's turn from that. But afterwards, our commission as Christians is to begin work on repairing the systems that are clearly harming people of color in our society. Recall the metaphor of the lake. One dead fish, we look at the fish. Half of the fish dead, we look at the water. And that's our mandate as Christians, looking at the water. So we're doing this section on history in the lesson to help us understand how we got to the place we are, because so many of the systems that do so much harm happen under the radar. They stay invisible. They work away day after day, year after year, generation after generation, but they take on language and they take on forms that appear innocent but that hide the harmful impact. So we looked last week at two important pieces of legislation in our nation's history, the Social Security Act of 1935 and the GI Bill after World War II, which were both race-neutral in language, which were both race-neutral legally. But when they were applied, we saw they were anything but race neutral. We're doing this section on history because if we're going to take up the work that Jesus gave us, the work of repairing the earth, we're going to need to see those hidden systems because that's where we need to go to work. Now, as we finished up last week looking at the GI Bill, we saw that the three provisions of the bill, housing, education, and job training, carried hidden, invisible factors that skewed advantage in favor of white people and made the provisions practically inaccessible to people of color. Now, in mentioning the housing provision, I mentioned the Federal Housing Administration. I want to pick up there and talk a little bit more about that today. I mentioned the policy of the FHA not to insure loans in red zone areas. You may have heard of the policy called redlining. To understand the full impact of that policy, it's important to understand how revolutionary FHA loans have been in our nation. Before the FHA came to say, we will insure mortgages for homeowners in our nation, to buy a home, you had to put down 50% of the value of the home, and you had to pay off the other 50% in 10 years. Consequently, very few people could afford home ownership. So we take the 10% down or 3% down 30-year loan, we take that for granted today, but it has not always been that way. It was not that way before 1935. Consequently, the introduction of the FHA turned home ownership on its head, and millions of Americans were able to buy homes that could never have done so without the FHA. So between 1934 and 1962, the federal government backed $120 billion in home loans. That made it possible for millions and millions of Americans to begin to accumulate equity in their homes. Consequently, with that equity now accrued in their homes, millions and millions of Americans were able to make significant life decisions on the basis of having the access to that accumulated equity. In my own life, my father's father borrowed against the equity of his home so that he could leave his job managing a grocery store and start a grocery store of his own. And that was in Redondo Beach, California, which was a booming metropolis. It started off as a sleepy little beach town, and by the time that it had grown, it was just this major part of Los Angeles. And it ended up that this chain of grocery stores that he eventually was able to open made him a very wealthy man, and it started with his home equity. And even though, because there was several deaths in our family and some other factors that happened, my own nuclear family kind of had to restart, economically speaking, from ground zero, or maybe a little bit below ground zero. Nevertheless, long after my grandfather had died, my grandmother still had the resources to act as a safety net for our small, broken little family. So when something critical came up, an emergency or a school trip that we could not have afforded, an educational need, help so that we wouldn't miss a house payment or food when times were lean, the compounding benefit of home equity allowed my grandmother to be a safety net for my mom and for my brothers and for me. Much of the progress that I have been able to make in life has come from the cumulative power of home equity, which is true for millions of Americans. Ever since the founding of the FHA, it's one of the primary ways families advance is through more equity in their homes. I mentioned last week that the finish line of one generation is often the starting line for the next generation because equity is often inherited. Equity provides access to capital. That capital can be borrowed against. Loans insured by the government fundamentally change the economic equation for millions of Americans. For some Americans, for white Americans. Because of those red zone restrictions instituted by the FHA from 1934 to 1964, 98% of all loans that were insured by the FHA went to white people, 98%. Again, the FHA was a race-neutral agency of the government, but in application, it was not race-neutral at all. Now again, I grew up in California where real estate went through a tremendous boom in much of the 20th century. That's when my grandparents were accumulating all that equity, the foundation of net worth that allowed them to be the safety net for our family when we were getting near falling off the grid, happened during those years from 1946 to 1960. And during those years, 350,000 new homes were built in California from 46 to 60. And of those 350,000, only 100 went to African Americans. The FHA, without ever mentioning race, assured that those numbers would be so. By insuring home loans in some areas and not in other areas, the FHA effectively created segregated housing, places where white people would live and places for black people not to live. Which meant that not only did generation after generation of people of color not get access to home ownership and to equity, but the schools and the municipal services that are funded by property taxes became increasingly disparate in quality. Invisible, race neutral, but profound in the advantages afforded to one group and profound in the disadvantage afforded to another group, year after year, generation after generation. As we've been seeing, history tells us how things got tangled so we can see what still needs untangling. And still today, even after the Fair Housing Act of 1968, when redlining was outlawed, still today, Black and Latino mortgage applicants are still 60% more likely than whites to be turned down for their loans, even after controlling for employment history, after controlling for credit scores, and after controlling for neighborhood in which the home would be purchased. In 1993, 86% of suburban whites still lived in neighborhoods with a black population of less than 1%. There's an ongoing legacy of these FHA policies. What was, still is. What was broken is still broken. What was wounding is still wounding. And since equity is one of the primary ways that families build wealth, it's no surprise that white families, on average, have 8 times more net worth than African-American families. If a white family and a black family both have the same annual income, the white family is still more likely to have at least 2 times as much net worth as the black family, and that's primarily because of home value and because of equity inherited from parents. And as we've said, a family's net worth is the finish line, but it's also the starting line for the children, for financing college, for assisting during hard times, difficult times, keeping people from falling through the cracks, assisting with a down payment for a home. These are the kinds of things that those numbers mean. Some economists estimate that about 80% of lifetime wealth depends upon intergenerational transfer. Home equity gets passed from grandparents to parents to children to grandchildren. One statistics in that documentary I found particularly troubling was that in 1865, right after emancipation, African Americans owned 0.5% of the United States assets. 0.5%. 135 years later, in 1990, African Americans owned 1% of all of the assets in the United States. Our systems are hidden, they're invisible, but they are not without fierce and destructive power. Even if race-neutral systems treat everyone the same, they still perpetuate very old systems that still advantage and still disadvantage. In 1974, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act tried to change things. It required banks to record the racial identity of applicants who were rejected and accepted for mortgages, which might have helped us see, and in the seeing, to change. But here's the thing, banks just did not comply. So in 1976, a suit was filed to make banks obey the law, which they did until 1981 when the court order ran out and when they stopped again. And then during the Reagan years, the Congress passed the Paperwork Reduction Act, and so record keeping stopped altogether. Who is not in favor of paperwork reduction? That's a great idea, except that now hidden systems can remain hidden. And still today, during the years leading up to the 2008 crisis, black households were more likely than similarly qualified white households to be steered into subprime loans. Black households were actually 3 times more likely than white households to have a subprime mortgage, even factoring in credit scores and property values. Subprime mortgages come with higher rates of interest. Subprime mortgages come with higher fees. They cost the borrower tens of thousands of dollars more over the lifetime, and they're much more likely because of rising interest rates to result in foreclosure. So in 2011, Bank of America settled a $335 million suit with the Department of Justice for having predatory practices that went specifically after people of color. From 2004 to 2008, 200,000 people of color were charged more for their mortgages than were similarly qualified white borrowers. Over a 30-year mortgage, subprime borrowers pay an average of $35,000 more for their loans. Consequently, they are 3 times more likely to be in foreclosure, which again represents the loss of billions of dollars in net worth, which was disproportionately borne by black folk, all while under the supervision of race-neutral banking laws. Now, that's a whole bunch of numbers. That's a whole bunch of history. But here's why those numbers, and here's why that history is important. Because the lives that we live are funded. The opportunities that help us move forward are funded. One of the primary ways families fund opportunity, one of the primary ways that families give their kids a leg up, is through home ownership and equity. And our invisible systems, our governmental systems, our real estate systems, our lending systems, our banking systems have, intentionally or not, they have advantaged some and they have disadvantaged others. And that was not just in the bad old days of yore. In our lifetimes, in this decade, happening right now in our city, in Raleigh. So even when the rules are the same for everybody, and even when access is the same for everybody, history is a launching pad for some, and it is a ball and chain for others. At a conference I attended, I heard a story of a woman who lived in New Orleans during Katrina. And like most, FEMA took a very long time getting money to her block. Like most, the insurance companies were stalling and stalling on her block. And like most, many on her block were underinsured. But unlike most of the people on her block, she didn't have to walk away from her home. Most could not wait out the institutional process required before rebuilding. But she was able to rebuild, and she was able to stay, and she was able to keep her home and maintain and hold on to her equity because she got a bridge loan from her father, who interestingly had bought a very small home right after World War II in California, of less than 1,000 square feet. He'd lived there for a long time, but property values had gone up. And consequently, he was able to move out and to rent his house out to cover the mortgage, which allowed him to go buy another small house. And he lived in that for a long time. And property values went up, which meant that the rent values went up so that he was able to rent that house out and go get another. So he had three houses. And over his lifetime, he had just kept paying off those houses, doing the maintenance on those houses, keeping them up. And he was able, because of the equity that he had accumulated in those three small houses in California, to use that money to make the bridge loan to her so that she was able to get through when the floods came. She didn't have to walk away from her equity. She kept her home. She kept the value of her home. She kept the options open for her children. While all around her, people had to leave the city and go build new lives and start from nothing, she was able to stay and rebuild and give options to her children. That's what economic systems do. That's what home ownership does. That's what banking policy does. That's what equity does. It's what capital does. And again, in all of these regards, history has advantaged some and has disadvantaged others. In an evening graduate class on education, a group of mid-career teachers were each taking a one-night-a-week, three-hour class. In one of those classes, the professor brought enough Monopoly boards for the whole class to play Monopoly for 3 hours. The rules were the same for everybody. The same amount of starting money was given to everybody. The same privileges and processes and rules applied to everybody, with one small catch. For the first 2 hours of the class, only the black students got to play. It was only in the third hour of the class that the white students got to start playing. And when they did, again, the rules were the same for everybody. Everybody got $200 when they passed go. Everybody started with the same cash, but you know what happened. Those who started late weren't playing the same game, not at all. They weren't competing for the same properties. Those properties were all bought and housed and hoteled. In fact, their best option, they discovered, was to try and go to jail. At least there you didn't have to roll the dice and you didn't have to pay a penalty to somebody. Now imagine it's not a board game. But just imagine it's your everyday life. Imagine it's your get up and go to work life. Imagine it's your raising the kids without enough money life. Imagine it's your drive further because housing isn't affordable life. Imagine it's your don't understand but can't afford tutoring life. Imagine the stress that causes. Imagine how that raises cortisol in your body. Imagine the surge of adrenaline it feels when you can't give your children what they need to succeed. Imagine the anger. Abstract policy decisions, conceptual banking laws, race-neutral legislative acts, they're not race-neutral at all, they create our everyday lives, lives that are stressful, everyday lives that can become so breakingly demoralizing, everyday lives that are so demanding that relationships suffer under the burden, so demanding, so undercutting that the social fabric that supports people gets gutted. Systems that people cannot self-help their way out of. Systems that people cannot positive thinking their way out of. Systems that people cannot Oprah their way out of. Systems that are destructive to human lives, to human families, to human children. And imagine if that was your day in and day out experience, how you might be tempted by excessive drinking. Imagine how you might be tempted to violence when those surging chemicals were a regular diet. Imagine how you might succumb to depression, excessive sleeping, or shopping, or TV watching, or eating, or any other coping strategy. And imagine how, whatever the coping strategy was, it might, as coping strategies do, become a downward spiral all of its own. This is the world that we inherited. And this is the repair work that Jesus has set before us. I've said this the last couple of weeks. The systems are so insidious because they're so hidden. They're so destructive because they're so invisible. I've had several people tell me over the course of this lesson, Doug, I really didn't know this stuff. I mean, I knew the system was rigged, kind of, but I didn't realize how much so and for how long, how deeply embedded the rigging was in our economic systems and our governmental systems and our medical systems and our educational systems. And by the way, Doug, I've been reading, and oh my Lord, you're only scratching the surface. That's what invisible does. I didn't realize. But hidden or not, these systems roll along year after year, destroying people, wounding people, hurting people. And that, Jesus taught us, is when Christians go to work. That is when it's time for our gig, healing what is broken, restoring what is lost, rebuilding what has been destroyed. Now, as I said, next week we're going to begin the last section of this lesson, What Shall We Do? But before we get there, I want to reiterate something that I said at the very beginning of this lesson, that no one of us is responsible for more than we can handle. After these 3 weeks of history, I hope you're paying attention. And if you're paying attention, oh my Lord, what can we do? What can we do? But before we even start there, we have to go back to this. No one of us is more responsible for it than we can handle. It just isn't how the spiritual life is. In the spiritual life, we're just given what we're responsible for. Not that. When we begin to see the consequences of our national sin, when we see the magnitude of the problem that we inherited, when we see the magnitude of the work that we are assigned, it can overwhelm us. It can feel immobilizing. It can crush hope. But more than we can handle, that's not how this thing works. Remember, we started the lesson looking at the magnitude of the systems that destroy and how they've been overwhelming from the beginning. What we are experiencing today is no different than what Jesus was talking about when his people were facing the destructive, oppressive power of Rome. And in that moment, Jesus said, here's what you're going to do in all of the moments when the destructive powers seem so dauntingly overwhelming. Look to the mustard seed. Look to the yeast. Not too much for any one of us, but something for all of us. We are not responsible to repair American society. We are not responsible to fix American governance. We are not responsible to fix American economics or American banking or America's education, but we are responsible to see the problem. And we are responsible to discern our part in repairing what is broken. We are responsible then to act and to do our part, our bit. And we are responsible to do it sustainably for as long as it takes. And it will take our whole lifetimes. And it will take our children's lifetimes. We will not have this problem solved by 2018 or 2020 or 2024. This will take our lifetimes. And so we set ourselves to a sustainable rhythm of doing what it takes to repair the earth. But before we get there, before we start brainstorming about what our parts might be, this: no follower of Jesus is assigned that. No one of us is assigned more than we can bear, just our part. And we do it while we are raising our children the best we can. We do it while we are going to work and taking care of our jobs. We do it while we are getting groceries and doing our jobs and sleeping and eating and loving and being loved. We do our part. We do our yeast part. We do our mustard seed part. And we do it for the rest of our lives. Sustainably, day in, day out, for the rest of our lives. And so, Lord, may we be attuned to the divine whispers. May we be discerners of that which actually moves the needle in our society. May we be courageous enough to take up our part and to walk this path of redemption, restoration, and wholeness making. In Jesus' name, amen.